Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Item 1, the fiscal cliff time machine. Item 2, the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee. Item 3, Furby. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Thursday, the 6th of December. Good as always to have you with us. And we begin once again with an update of sorts on the fiscal cliff. I say of sorts because nobody really said anything much about it today. And in fact, what Washington has been saying about the fiscal cliff this year sounds a whole lot like what it was saying last year about the debt limit. So we move now to round 3 of our game show, the Fiscal Cliff Time Machine, trademark. You know how it works. I play you 2 pieces of tape. You decide which one is this year. Today, our guest is Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner. Here you go. Is it choice 1 from this year?
What we're not going to do is extend those tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans. Remember, those cost $1 trillion over 10 years. And there's no possibility that we're going to find a way to get our fiscal house in order without those tax rates going back up.
Or is it choice 2 from this year?
And so he's proposed some totally sensible tax reforms that would eliminate loopholes and ask the wealthiest 2% of Americans to pay a modest additional share of the burden.
If you know which one is which, and actually I don't today, tweet us at MarketplaceAPM. You can get me at Kai Rizdahl. The answer to yesterday's quiz at the end of the show. You got to stick around, though. Now for some fiscal cliff talk that is definitely 2012. Max Baucus is the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee. Senator, good to have you here.
Thank you, Kai. Good to hear your voice. Good to be here.
Senator, the White House, as you know, is being pretty firm in saying that Republicans need to accept higher taxes on the wealthy. And I do wonder what Democrats are willing to give. I mean, Congresswoman Pelosi and yourself are on record as not wanting to change entitlements too much, not wanting to raise retirement ages too much. I mean, what are Democrats willing to give?
Well, I number one, I think rates have to be higher. If the Speaker does not agree to higher rates, it's going to be very, very difficult to get a deal. On entitlements side, I believe strongly that if there's some give on rates, there'll be give on entitlements as well by the president and by Democrats generally.
To be clear, you think the president is going to have to give on entitlement reform in some way, shape, or form?
I do think he will, so long as the Speaker and Republicans also agree to some rate increase.
Mm-hmm. All right, so bear with me for a second here, sir. We've been playing this game on the show this week. We're calling it the Fiscal Cliff Time Machine, and we've been playing pieces of tape of President Obama and Speaker Boehner and having people guess whether it's what they said last year for the fiscal debt ceiling debate or whether it's what they said this year. Because you know what? They sound almost exactly the same. People in Washington are saying the exact same thing. Same words, same rhythm, same cadence. And so my question to you out of this is, why should we, anybody, believe that things are going to change, that people understand what's at risk here if you guys can't even have a real conversation about it?
Well, it's a good point. The proof's in the pudding. You know, it's deeds, not words. And we'll see. There's a lot of talk around here of both sides. But my view is we've got to no choice but to do the best we can, go forward, because things have to change.
One last thing, sir, before I let you go. If we couldn't fix it last year and we can't fix it this year, and we all know that Congress never acts until its back is against the wall, and here we are pretty much against the wall, when?
Well, I think we'll do it. And if we don't, by the end of this year, we're going to have to regroup very aggressively the first of next year, because getting next year, we will have then gone off the cliff.
Max Baucus, Democrat from Montana. He's the chairman of the Senate Committee on Finance. Senator, thanks a lot for your time.
Thanks, Kai, very much, and good luck to you.
Near as I can tell, the fiscal cliff was pretty much awash on Wall Street. Today we'll have the details when we do the numbers. We'll be right back. The latest pronouncement from the good people at the S&P Case-Shiller Home Price Index just before Thanksgiving was that home prices are now up 6 months in a row, which is A, nice, and B, economically critical, because as Sally Herships explains, a single home in this economy has an amazing trickle-down effect.
If you're a renter, you may worry you're wasting money by not investing your rent dollars. But at least you don't have to worry about taking on the role of handyman, trying to figure out how to rip out that weird, too-big fireplace on the second floor of your new house.
Does that involve a sledgehammer?
Yes. And friends.
Mark Corbin lives in South Orange, New Jersey. He and his wife have been renters for the past 10 years, until spring, when they bought their new house. And they bought a lot more supplies than they expected.
Sheetrock and plywood and mud and paint and tools and, you know, all the stuff that you never need when you rent because you have a landlord.
Now Corbin has shag carpet to rip out and pink and lavender walls to repaint. Then there's the outside of the house.
Is that a sprinkler?
Yeah, I had to buy one of those too. Because I had a lawn. I don't know of anyone who can just move in and just sit and just be happy with the way everything is. There's always something else that needs, you know, doing a repairing.
Bad news for Corbin's wallet, but good news for the economy. It's the enthusiastic spending by new homeowners like Corbin that helped drive it. To understand how easy it is for new homeowners to be lured into spending, I visited the temple of home repairs, Home Depot.
Did that sign say 600 choices available for toilets?
Yeah, you can get any toilet from a basic toilet to one that...
Vinny Merlo is Home Depot's local district manager. He says the spending can start with something as simple as a doorknob. Say you're thinking brushed chrome.
The brushed chrome on the outside, now the brushed chrome has to be on the inside.
Because, of course, you want everything to match. But now you need to save so you get a new energy-efficient storm door. You see where this is going. No other single consumer purchase ripples through the economy like the sale of a house, old like the Corbins or brand new.
This is the major purchase that households make.
Susan Wachter teaches real estate and finance at Wharton.
Someone that's buying a new home, a newly constructed home, that has immediate consequences in terms of construction jobs.
The rule of thumb, Wachter says, is for every newly constructed house sold, one new job is created. But that's just the beginning. That job means a paycheck, which means spending. The housing market has been off, but Wachter says it's beginning to come back.
As the housing market improves, housing prices increase, and that has a wealth impact. People are wealthier, they feel wealthier, consumer confidence increases.
But not to the point where every home buyer is ready to take on an old house. The love affair with an old house, over.
Totally over for me. Totally over.
Paul Wadil is a new homeowner, also in South Orange. His last home was old, so this time he bought new. He didn't want to have to replace his front door.
Let's check out this door. So it seals out the cold nicely?
Absolutely. Insulating door that never, it closes securely. The lock works on it, all that stuff.
Wadil says he and his wife have barely had to lift a finger to make changes to their new home. But there is a but.
To be honest, we paid more than we wanted to pay for a house, but that's what we paid for.
Wadil says the lesson he's learned as a homeowner is you can pay now or you can pay later. In New York and renting, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
We've been doing a fair bit of reporting on the program about the fossil fuel boom this country is having, how we're drilling more than we can use right now. There is even talk that we could become a petroleum exporter. And a government report out now seems to support that argument that exporting natural gas provides net economic gain. The key word there being net, because that's another way of saying there are going to be winners and some losers. And this being energy policy, you can bet there's going to be a fight. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
The report comes to a not surprising conclusion. If you have a low-cost item, market up and sell lots of it abroad, whether it's cotton or almonds or natural gas, the economy gains. Cheniere Energy has made the argument for years. It runs natural gas export terminals. CEO Sharif Souki says the U.S. has a glut of natural gas on the order of several billion cubic feet, or BCF.
We don't know what to do with this gas. So what are we going to do with it? Not sell it? That's great. Every BCF is 50,000 jobs. Every BCF is $3 or $4 billion a year.
The Energy Department will use the report as it decides whether to allow new exports of natural gas. But opponents have their math, too. The U.S. chemical industry buys cheap gas as a raw material, and for now is outcompeting much of the world. Export too much, and you increase prices, argues Seth Roberts at Dow Chemical.
The longer we can stay with affordable, predictable prices that are good for both producers and consumers, the better off our country will be.
Also against exports, protectionists, and fossil fuel critics. In the end, the market may put on the brake. It's unclear how long U.S. prices will stay low or how much demand is really out there. Michael Levy is with the Council on Foreign Relations.
I think there's going to be a limit to how many potential exporters can really line up the financing that they need to deliver.
Either way, we have a political fight over exporting energy, one that the country hasn't had in 50 years. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
One of the reasons we've got all that extra energy to export is because of something called guar gum. You may not know what it is, you may not even have heard of it, but chances are you've put it in your mouth or on your hair. Guar gum is a thickener, is about as scientific as I'm going to get. It goes in ice cream and in shampoo, and it's a key ingredient in fracking. And because of that, its price has been on one seriously wild ride this year. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has that story.
Frackers inject guar gum into cracks in the earth after they blast into shale rock miles underground. Kelly Youngblood heads investor relations at Halliburton, one of the biggest frackers in the world.
You have to have something to keep it open, okay? Because you can fracture it, open it up, but over time the earth will settle and all of those channels that you have created will essentially close.
As fracking took off, so did guar gum prices. Then there was a bad harvest in India, the guar gum capital. Guar gum went from about $1 a pound in 2010 to $12 a pound earlier this year. Halliburton's profits took a hit, and the company took action, says Youngblood.
So we went out and bought a significant supply, a strategic reserve of guar, to ensure that we didn't run out.
The global supply of guar gum got even tighter, and prices got even higher. That's when market forces stepped in, says Dan Monternock, a commodities analyst for Doan Advisory Services.
High prices discourage consumption and encourage production.
Farmers planted guar like crazy, just as companies like Halliburton started developing cheaper substitutes. Supply soared, demand fell, and just as quickly as guar gum prices spiked, they dove, says oil trader and analyst Stephen Shork.
Prices are now regressing to where they were just a few years ago.
Guar gum's now cheaper than the substitute Halliburton developed. For now. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Coming up.
You start to project or see autonomous behavior, and then you're not sure if it's alive or not. And so it becomes creepy.
Yeah, you bet it does. And it's a toy. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials added 39 points today, 0.3%, finished at 13,074. The NASDAQ ticked up 15 points, about 0.5%, 29.89. The number of the S&P 500 gained 4 points, 0.3%, ended things at 14.13. Tech stocks were a bright spot. Apple rebounded with a 1.5% gain today. CEO Tim Cook said in an interview with NBC Tonight and Bloomberg Businessweek that a line of Macs is going to be built in the U.S. starting next year. Intel also charged up 1.5%. Cisco Systems rose 1.4%. H&R Block added 5% today. The tax prep company beat estimates by cutting costs during the slow summer months. Few investors, though, like the looks of the Men's Warehouse today. The clothing store unraveled 2.75% after missing earnings expectations. Citigroup raked in 1.5%. J.P. Morgan Chase and Goldman Sachs each rose about 0.6% today. Bond prices, well, they were up. Thanks for asking. The yield on the 10-year T-note edged down to 1.58%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Labor Department issues November unemployment figures. The Federal Reserve is scheduled to release consumer credit data for October. And on December 7, 1909, the first synthetic plastic was patented. Bakelite had industrial applications, and it was also made into neat things like napkin rings and jewelry. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. An outfit called the Golden Spike Company made some news today. It proposes, before the decade is out, landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the Earth. Now, the trip is going to cost you. Golden Spike says somewhere in the ballpark of $1.5 billion for two people for that private company ride to the moon. That is a whole lot of money for a country or a company, as Marketplace's David Gura explains.
There hasn't been a man on the moon since Apollo 17, almost 40 years ago. Jim Munsey is a space policy consultant, and he says there's still a lot to learn about our nearest celestial neighbor.
Well, there's a tremendous amount of science that can be done on the moon.
Geological experiments, astronomers could build telescopes there. But there are also commercial opportunities for mining. There's ice in craters near the poles and oxygen locked up in silicate minerals. Max Vosoff is in charge of business development for the Golden Spike Company, and he says to harness that, you have to get there.
What we really want to do is open up the transportation system.
International treaties prohibit any one country from claiming sovereignty over the moon, but Vosoff says there's nothing that prevents a company like his from doing business there. The goal is to bring the cost of manned missions to the moon in line with what NASA spends on unmanned missions.
They are spending about the same on a robotic mission, a robotic orbiter, as we feel we can charge for two people on the surface of the moon.
But not everyone is convinced that's possible. Jim Bell teaches in the School of Earth and Space Exploration at Arizona State.
I think there's a lot of skepticism about being able to meet that kind of a cost target for such a complex enterprise.
Bell wishes them luck, but he worries cost containment could lead to cutting corners. Much of the money spent on the Apollo missions was to make them as safe as possible. I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
The average public school building in this country is more than 40 years old, and the 21st Century School Fund says fixing up all those buildings would cost hundreds of billions of dollars. Our education correspondent Amy Scott has spent time this year at a school that just got a big makeover, Euler School in Cincinnati. It's part of an experiment in education that says if you're going to fix a school where most of the kids live in poverty, you have to take on that poverty itself. And after a $21 million renovation, Euler has new lighting and paint and all the latest classroom technology. And Amy explains all that stuff really matters.
Let's start with the old carpet.
This was all a brown, grimy carpet. Didn't matter how many times we cleaned it, it stunk.
Craig Hockenberry is principal of Euler School. It was built in 1930, a palace of brick and terracotta in its day. But for years, it had been showing its age. Dark and dreary hallways, peeling paint, flickering fluorescent lights, and the bathrooms?
I mean, I wouldn't even go to the bathroom in it. And the water fountains, I wouldn't even take a sip out of them. They were that bad. I mean, it was awful.
And in the fall and late spring, it was hot. Nancy Winett has taught at Euler for 27 years.
There were days it was 104 in our classrooms. It was very hard to, even for the kids to stay awake. They would lay their heads down. We'd have kids leave the classroom to throw up.
It would be tough for anyone to learn in that kind of environment. And these kids already have it tougher than most. They walk to school past boarded up buildings and drug deals and often go home at night to hunger and violence.
Their lives are, in a lot of cases, are really a web of a tangled mess sometimes. So when they come to school, they're so easily distracted.
Those distractions, the noise, the heat, the grime, send a message.
A poor building imparts a poor attitude, and it has an effect on learning.
David Thompson is chair of educational leadership at Kansas State University. He says decades of research have made a pretty strong case that lighting, noise, air quality, and basic aesthetics all affect how well students learn.
It doesn't take a Cadillac in order to do the job, but it takes a school building where children feel valued, where teachers feel valued, and where the environment and the surroundings don't get in the way.
The new Oiler, it's fair to say, is a Cadillac. After 2 years and a $21 million makeover, the school reopened in its original building in late August.
The staircase is right here.
Students pour into the brightly lit hallways, searching for their classrooms.
3015, look on the door right here.
The walls are creamy white, the floors spotless linoleum. Big windows look out to a colorful playground with a fountain and freshly paved basketball court. Jamie Lugan is Oiler's resource coordinator. She helps connect students with services like counseling and hands out packages of food for weekends, so she knows them pretty well.
So coming here and seeing all of their faces when they walk through the door, like, oh my gosh, look at this place. We're going to a real school. And just knowing that they are going to have all the advantages that are offered in this school building, a beautiful building. I mean, how can you not come in here with a positive attitude?
Senior Crystal Cornegay has been at Oiler since second grade.
Normally people leave Oiler because they say, like, it's in Lower Price Hill, a bad neighborhood. But now since it's rebuilt, everybody wants to attend this school now. Everybody thinks, like, they want to get this school a try.
Do they ever? Enrollment has jumped so much, Oilers had to bring in several new teachers. It wasn't hard to recruit them. The school doesn't just look better. The science department has real lab equipment, and every classroom is wired with internet access and a smart board.
It's just unbelievable for me. I just never thought in my career, which is now 32 years, that I would ever be in a building so impressive.
English teacher Nancy Wynett says kids are more engaged and have a better attitude.
In our old building, the kids would write on the walls and they would trash our bathrooms and just didn't really respect the building that we had. But, you know, people aren't writing on the walls. The kids are enjoying the fresh air. They're more motivated.
And those 104-degree classrooms? The new Oiler has central air, so the school can shut the windows to what goes on outside. In Cincinnati, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
The before and after pictures of Oiler and the rest of Amy's stories from her series are at marketplace.org. I am reliably told that the hot toy this year, the must-have flying off the shelves hot toy this year, is Furby. Small, furry, animatronic with its own language, and an item that, when it originally came out in 1998, was also the hot toy, which I guess explains why Hasbro is bringing it back. Caleb Chung helped invent the thing. Welcome to the program.
Good to be here. Thanks.
So I have to tell you, I heard the Furby was back, and I thought, man, that is so 1998.
It was a very good year for me.
I bet, and we'll talk about that actually in a little while. But yeah. But the question is, why is that thing so continuously popular?
So let's say you have a daughter and you have a whole room full of toys and she plays with them, but she that old ratty teddy bear is what she wants to sleep with. Why does that happen?
I don't know.
It's emotional bonding, and that's the enduring glue that makes something keep coming back.
So for me, it was always kind of creepy, the Furby was.
Yeah.
You know, it's a fine line, right, between emotional bond and creepy?
Nah, they call it the uncanny valley, but right. As you approach kind of reality, and obviously Furby is approaching at a very shallow angle, you start to project or see autonomous behavior, and then you're not sure if it's alive or not. And so it becomes creepy.
So this must be really the best year you've had in like 15 years since 1998, right, with them coming back?
Well, we've sold other products, but this was really a surprise. I had no advance notice of this once you license it. Everything's a surprise. No, I found out when I was pitching another toy to Hasbro, and they said, well, that's great, but it may interfere with the success of Furby. I'm like, what?
Man. So you know what that is, right? It's a business, baby.
It is a business. It is.
Now, are you still living comfortably on the back of Furby?
Yeah. Furby been very, very good to me. Yes. Well, we don't sit on it. We spent the last 4 years promoting a school of art and science here in Boise called, his new name is Fresco. And, you know, so we've been really focused on trying to give others the chance that we've had.
Caleb Chung helped invent Furby, Lothies, many years ago. We got him in Boise, Idaho. Caleb, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, one that Amazon and Apple and anybody else who makes ebook readers is probably laughing at all the way to the bank. A story in the New York Times that says bed bugs are now starting to be found on library books. To be clear, I love libraries. To be extra clear, I love real books. But ew, right? Okay, also, as promised, the answer to yesterday's Fiscal Cliff Time Machine, trademark, featuring Speaker of the House John Boehner as our guest. We will play those two pieces of tape again, just to refresh. Was choice one from this year?
There is no agreement. There's no deal in private.
Or was choice two from this year?
Right now, I would say we're nowhere. Period. We're nowhere.
Anyone? Anyone? Bueller? Choice two it is. Go to the head of the class if you got it right and play today's installment at marketplace.org. All right, we're done. We got to go. The Dow up 39 points today, 0.3%. The NASDAQ ticked up 15 points, about 0.5%. The S&P 500 gained 4 points on this Thursday, 0.3%. John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, George Judson, Jonathan Karp, Betsy Streisand, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The acting managing editor is Ethan Lindsay. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Join us back here tomorrow, won't you? And this is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.